Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word.
We're here today. It's the 26th of May, and it is my pleasure to be joined on the podcast by Dr. Christine Patch, who is the lead for genetic counselling at Genomics England and also our Caldecott Guardian. And Christine, you're also the principal staff scientist in genomic counselling in the Society and Ethics Research Group and various other important roles. Welcome to the pod. And if we can start maybe just with a bit of your background. No one is kind of born holding these eminent roles. How did you get into this space and how did that evolve for you?
Well, I've had a very meandering career with no clear sense of direction, I have to say. But I started off as a nurse in the late 1970s, which shows you how old I am. Did a degree after my nursing training and eventually ended up getting a job as a genetic nurse in Southampton in the late 80s. And really, it went from there. So during the last 30 years, we've developed the profession of genetic counselling. I did a PhD, I did a postdoc. I ended up as a clinical manager in a service in London, seeing patients, but also managing the team. And then in 2016, I decided I needed a new challenge and joined Genomics England. That's a potted history.
We're very glad to have you. And tell us a little bit about, if we go back to the 80s, this was before the days of the Human Genome Project and all of the advances in kind of scale sequencing that we've seen over the last decade or more. What did genetic medicine look like in those days? What was done and what did the doctors do? What did the patients do? What kind of questions were you working on and so on?
It was a small specialty, but a growing specialty. It was primarily concerned with what might be called classical genetic conditions. So rare syndromes with a probable genetic cause, and also family history of things that we knew were likely to be inherited. We had very few genetic tests. Laboratory scientists could look down a microscope, see chromosomes and count them and see fairly large changes in bits missing and bit extra. There was a technique called polymerase chain reaction, which is it had just come in then. So that was the first sort of technical revolution. And that enabled you to magnify large quantities of DNA. And you could look for random variation, not for particular genes or not for particular changes in genes, but just the variation between people. And so it was an exciting time with potential for genetic testing, but not really, that wasn't really being realised at that time. And I started when the Huntington's gene was mapped. In gene discovery, we knew that there were these inherited conditions. So Huntington's, we knew the inheritance of it. But we didn't know where the gene was. We could do nothing. We could do no genetic testing. And then the gene was mapped to the end of chromosome 4. And it became possible to track the gene through families and work out who might have inherited the gene and who might not. And that brought the possibility of predictive testing for the very first time. So I joined to start visiting families, perhaps taking blood samples, saying this was coming down the line and working with my medical genetic colleagues and actually psychiatric specialist colleagues to develop a programme for predictive testing because there were lots of anxieties about it. So it was exciting times.
And at Huntington's, just give us a bit of a flavour of how that affects people because it's particularly interesting because it is an adult onset condition, if I'm right, right? So there's a really interesting psychological question there, as you point to, around how can we help people to understand that they may or may not have this condition when they're younger? Like, how did those kind of conversations happen?
It's a neurological condition, so you get neurological changes. It's a movement disorder. And it is also, you can also get psychiatric problems with it. It's autosomal dominant. So if your parent has it, then there's a 50-50 chance that you will inherit it. Still today, although work it has got a lot better and there's a lot more research going on, there still is no treatment or prevention, really. And as you say, the commonest age of onset is in adulthood. There is a childhood form and you can get it very late. We now know, because, of course, once you identify the gene, you understand more about the condition. So this was pre-HIV. And if you think about it, oh, it was around the time of HIV. And so we were starting to think about how to counsel people where you were having a test which just gave you information, but really devastating information, but information that you could possibly use to plan your life choices, for Huntington's, to make decisions about whether or not to have children, or indeed have prenatal diagnosis, which became a possibility. But there was a lot of concern that people would commit suicide, that they would have if they found out they had the gene. This wasn't borne out, in fact. What was very surprising in the early days was the difficult psychological adjustment that people had to make if they found they didn't have the genetic variation, because they then had to live the rest of their lives without Huntington's. Well, without Huntington's for themselves, but still with Huntington's in the family. So they may have made life choices that they then regretted. And what was also interesting, before the possibility of predictive testing came about, there was an indication that a large number of people would take it up. That didn't manifest itself, which was also interesting. So if I was doing predictive test counselling, I'd be exploring with people, why now? You can't predict how you're going to react to this, but sort of let's do some rehearsal of things that might happen. Who will you tell? We could talk about this all day, but there is another big issue which you alluded to there, which is for families with inherited diseases, a big issue is how do we tell our children? And I've been involved in research programmes on that, and involved in actually more recent research using family therapy techniques to try and develop ways of helping people communicate in families. As parents, we want to protect our children from absolutely everything. But as children know what's going on in their family. And the sort of general way of thinking about it is, this is a difficult conversation, but it's part of your family's story. The worst thing to do is wait until they're teenagers, wait until one of them turns up pregnant, or they introduce you to their future life partner, or at funerals, or at Christmas when the family's all together.
Yeah, they're very, very human stories, aren't they? So you mentioned polymerase chain reaction in the 80s. Of course, if we fast forward to 2020, 2021, PCR, polymerase chain reaction testing, is on everyone's lips, of course, because of all of the testing around the coronavirus and the pandemic. Yeah. And we're now able to sequence people's whole genome very rapidly, reasonably cheaply, and use that to inform clinical decision making and all of these other human choices that you've talked about. Today, there's a lot of discussion in the media about data and how data is used. You mentioned even back in the 80s, getting blood samples, doing those tests that generates those kinds of data sets. This is maybe a very, very broad question, but how can we think about this balance between that data being something very intimate about a person and their family and their community, the need for researchers to understand at a group level how we can use those data sets to understand what's happening in someone's gene and what's happening with their body and the kind of effects that has, and at the same time be able to re-identify those data sets to actually help individual doctors help individual patients. How can we start to unpick this whole tangled knot of thorny issues?
Well, we can't do it in half an hour, that's for sure. It's really complex. And I suppose if I go back to my rare disease world, rare disease families really understand that data is important. You know, examining the family's genetics, bringing together groups of people with individual rare diseases to examine their genetics and try and understand what's going on, what's causing it, has the potential to lead to both diagnosis and potential treatments. So they understand the power of data. They also understand the power of data for describing the natural history of a condition. So if you think about the very rare diseases. Many of them were only classified, you know, 70s, 80s, 90s. We don't know what the prognosis really is for a child with one of those rare diagnoses who's diagnosed early, who in 30 years' time. And we will only get to know that if we aggregate the data together and understand that in a better way. So data is a very powerful tool that can be used for very positive things. However, when one's thinking about data that is very personal and private and sensitive to one, I think that's where the Caldecott stuff or Guardian role fits in. I'm not an expert in data governance. I'm not a legal expert. I work with an excellent team, an ethics team, legal team, information governance specialists, experts in GDPR. But I think what Caldecott, I mean, her immense contribution, and very sadly she died earlier this year, but her immense contribution are the review of information governance that she carried out in the late 90s and the development of these Caldecott principles. And fundamentally, it is related to care, social care and healthcare, but it's completely transferable, I think, to what we do in Genomics England. It's about to share or not to share. And for me, actually, the most positive principle is the most recent, which is Principle 8, which can be distilled down into no surprises. If I, as a citizen, am allowing you access to data that is personal, sensitive, confidential to me, I want no surprises about what happens to that data. And at Genomics England, I think we work very hard about transparency. Obviously, we comply with the law. Obviously, there's structures around information governance. But we are really trying to be transparent with our participants who say yes to allow access to data, to be transparent about the uses to which that data is put, and also involve them in making decisions about the uses to which that data is put.
Absolutely. So in trying to balance these things, I guess where we've ended up is having the data in what we call a trusted research environment to allow de-identified access for researchers to do that, but also to have this kind of live wire back into a clinical treatment where that can help with an individual case. Just explain to us a bit about how that works. How can we do both of these things at once?
Again, it's really complex, and I think we're working through that at scale. I think the principle at the moment under which we hold our data in what we might call the research environment is that we will aim not to re-identify people, that we'll aim that researchers don't de-identify people as an individual. So research analysis is about looking at groups of data. It's about comparing one group to another group. But if a researcher in their analysis finds out that there's a variant in an individual, which they won't know who that individual is, but they will know it's in an individual that might explain their condition, then we need to work with the NHS to get back to them. And it's about, in a sense, putting a barrier in place between the research environment and the clinical environment, but having tools and mechanisms to jump over the barrier and get that particular piece of information that's relevant to that particular individual's care back to the care team that are responsible for their care. That's easy to say. It's actually incredibly difficult and time consuming to do, but it is happening. It is a new world. It's a new data world. You know, I'm not an expert in data regulation, but changes in data regulation have affected the way we work. And the old days of the sort of clinical academic working completely immersed in the clinical and academic space are probably more difficult now. And it's about understanding that we have permission, we have consent of different kinds, we have the legal basis for using information in the clinical space, and we have it for using in the academic space. But for good reasons, there's a barrier between them that we can't forget. But we also need to make it easier to get the right information across that barrier without raising the risk of not maintaining our commitments to our participants about protecting their confidential information. And it's a tricky balance.
It is. But I guess if we get that right, and you know, we continue to work with both doctors and clinical teams in the NHS and the patients and participants whose data it is to make sure that collectively we're trying to design the optimal systems. If we can do that well, your point about looking at groups, this allows us to link these different data sets together to actually try and understand some of those pieces of the puzzle that for this group who, let's say, for example, might have lung cancer, if we can link that to their smoking status from their GP record, or for people who have a particular rare condition, we can look at, for that group, which members of this group have been prescribed medicine X versus medicine Y, and how has that changed, and what does that tell us about people who have this going on in their genome, and so on. Do you think that we're doing enough to explain both why we need these data sets, how we're using them in a way which protects privacy, but also allows us to feed back those individual results that are relevant? And how could we think about making that even clearer or more transparent to regular human beings, either doctors or patients or participants or whatever? How can we think about trying to explain some of these really complex topics?
It's really complex and difficult, but I think underpinning is an acceptance that we hold, use, access this data with the trust of the people whose data it is. And it's about maintaining that trust and recognising the complexity of the systems that we need to build to maintain that trust. So at a very simple level, for example, in our situation at the moment, we hold the data in our research environment with the consent of an individual participant. And of course, participants can withdraw, and they do. So we have built systems that mean that we know who's withdrawn and who hasn't, so that we can, again, maintain our commitments. I think it's also about being honest about the necessity to link data, that we won't generate these discoveries if we don't link the data. But that doesn't mean we as a society, we as Genomics England, don't have an obligation to do that responsibly.
Let's get onto an even more thorny topic now, which is then access to those de-identified data sets by researchers, whether academic researchers or biotech or pharmaceutical companies, and also for biotech and pharmaceutical companies to be paying for access to that data. And so this is often framed as we're selling NHS data, or this is kind of privatizing NHS data. The counterargument being, well, if we give this data away for free to these commercial entities and then they develop a drug and then sell it back to us, actually, that's not a fair deal for the NHS or for UK PLC. It's a very emotive topic. How can we strike that? But I guess both the substance of it, how can we get that balance right, and the communication of it, how can we, I guess, start to be more confident in explaining what we're doing and why and how that's based on trust?
The first point to make is that for some people, that is not right. You know, for some members of our society, etc., that is not right. And they need to be able to say that that is not right. So for me, a fundamental principle, again, is about transparency, is about saying that, you know, for example, in the 100,000 Genomes Project, researchers from both commercial and non-commercial organisations were allowed access to data. And that wasn't a choice. We didn't give people a choice about that in that project. You could give people a choice about that, perhaps, if you have the systems to make that work, but we didn't. So, but it's about being transparent about that and accepting that for some people that wasn't right. It's also being, I think, for me, transparent about the reality, and the rare disease community and the cancer community and patient advocate community accept this. You know, the reality is we are not going to develop large-scale treatments, diagnostic therapies in totally within a university academic environment. And also, if I could be provocative also for a minute, the blurring between commercial and non, or for-profit and not-for-profit, is grey. You know, I've had the experience of working in universities. I've had the experience of getting grants and making grant applications and the thorny issue of intellectual property. You know, we get a lot of very good spin-outs from academic institutions. So it's grey. It's not necessarily that it's all good on one side and all bad on the other side. So for me, it's about being honest and transparent, and I think that feeds into trust. There's also something about benefit sharing, which we need to work through. So that's benefit sharing for, perhaps an individual rare disease group or the NHS. So there's something about benefit sharing, which is really complex that we need to work through. Because what people really, well, this is a generalisation, but what we know from a public dialogue that we did for the social contract work in Genomics England and from other research, what people get exercised about is profiteering, however you describe that. That's a very big word, a loose word, but it's about profiteering, unfairly profiteering from my personal sensitive and confidential data.
There's a really important theme that you've brought out around informed choice. And how do we distill some of these complex topics in a way which makes it clear what we're talking about, and which also respects the intelligence and expertise of many of the patients and participants in this field, who I've been gobsmacked over and over again by how expert individuals and families become in the condition that that is affecting them or their family. So there's this big thing about informed choice, and then about transparency on what you're making choices about. I've really noticed actually the push to us as Genomics England, to me individually, often these individuals and groups want us to be doing more. As you say, right, why aren't you doing more with our data that we've shared with you? Why aren't we getting more treatments? How can we accelerate the research that's being done in this space? And that actually the value exchange that you've talked about, the sort of the fairness, is in we've shared this data with you, we're explaining what it's like to live with this condition. The quid pro quo is you need to be enabling the research which is going to actually develop treatments to make my life or my kid's life or my family's life better. So I guess there's something there in balancing this transparency, the choices we're making, and also being clear about the exchange that's going on. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, it is. And I think if we, picking up on the informed choice, I mean, that really came about, well, when we were thinking about the Genomic Medicine Service, or NHS England was thinking about the Genomic Medicine Service, a big part of that was the offer to, or the research offer to the anybody having a whole genome sequencing test, that they would allow access to their data, et cetera, et cetera, within a research environment in the same way that 100,000 genome participants did. And we spent a long time talking about this. And we actually came up with this framework of actually in the clinic, you are being given a choice about having a genetic test. And this is where my colleagues sometimes disagree with me, but actually you don't get a choice about the technology for that test. So if whole genome sequencing is what the NHS has recommended and is paid for, you get whole genome sequencing because that is the test. So your choice is about the test for the reason you've come to the hospital or the GP surgery or wherever. And you need information about that. You also, at the time of the Genomic Medicine Service being set up, it included creating a virtual network of labs working as one network. And that's really important. Going back to those earlier comments about interpreting genomes, it's really important that if a lab finds something unusual in the genome, but doesn't have quite enough information to put it on the side of yes or no, that they can have access to information from the other labs in the network. You know, have you seen a patient like this? Have you, you know, what decision did you make? But that is a sort of national data sharing for clinical use that we have been transparent about in the Genomic Medicine Service. So the choice to have the test also includes within the Genomic Medicine Service, allowing data sharing for that purpose and understanding that your data will be compared to everybody else and everybody else's will be compared to you. And then the separate choice is about whether to give consent for research. And to do that, the participants, I think, need to know about what their data may be used for. We can't be totally specific. It has to be broad because we can't be specific about future uses, but also have access to information. For some participants, they don't want very much more information. For others, they want a lot of information. And we need to provide resources and tailored information and information at different levels, but that is always transparent, honest and truthful.
Absolutely. So there's those two separate choices. One is, am I comfortable with the clinical data sharing within the NHS as part of the diagnosis and treatment of my condition? And then a separate choice about, am I comfortable to share my data on a de-identified basis for researchers to work on who might be able to advance the research in the in the field where I or my family or my community kind of have this condition. How have you found in your conversations with patients? I don't know if it's possible to generalize because we're all so different, but how have you found people work through those choices? What's important to them as they're making those choices?
Well, that's going to be very individual. I think for a medical test, if we want a diagnosis and we want the testing that's available, then there's less balance about that decision. If you've come to a doctor for an answer to your medical problem, you expect the doctor to do the best tests that are necessary for you to get the answers. In terms of the research choice, people are concerned. We know what worries people. It is about insurance companies accessing data. It is about marketing. It is about using the data to unfairly discriminate. It is about security services. It is about police. And we can't just say, you know, those are legitimate concerns, and different communities, different individuals, because of their lived experience, will have different viewpoints on that, and we have to accept that those are valid. So it's not about persuasion or coercion, it's about a conversation and understanding where people are coming from, really, for me. And that brings me back to my genetic counselling skills.
Completely. And I guess it brings us straight back to trust as well, right? Because we need to be able to answer those questions in a way which we can build trust that's not the case. And so you mentioned insurance companies and the link between those data sets and individual insurance premiums and so on, which I think I'm right in saying, again, I'm not a lawyer, but it is not possible to use it for that basis. It's not identifiable. It can't be linked by an insurance company and so on. But we need to find the right ways to reassure people that it's not just, well, you know, look me in the eye, trust me, this is okay. Why should people believe that the police don't have access to these records, that insurance companies don't, and so on? And I guess that brings us back to systems and the law and so on. But in your conversations, what do you think is the most effective way of providing that reassurance or building that trust?
It's about being honest in what I'm saying. So, for example, again, because I've been around for so long, I've been very involved throughout the development of the discussions with the Association of British Insurers and the Department of Health, which has created this memorandum of understanding. So insurance companies can't ask for the results of a predictive genetic test. There's some financial limits on the type of insurance, but they're fairly high. And I think that's been a very powerful thing in the UK. And I have to say, I think the most powerful thing in the UK has been the NHS, because we generally don't pay for healthcare. And many of the arguments about the insurance industries came from the States, where you could potentially be completely uninsurable on the basis of your genetic makeup until GINA was brought in. So it's context specific. And I always use this discussion about insurance I'm very pro NHS to say, you know, at least that is one of the benefits of the NHS. It's not perfect, but it's partly mitigated against those discussions. Yeah. So again, it comes back to being seen as trustworthy. And for me, that's about being genuine and honest and transparent.
If we lift our eyes, I guess, a bit to the horizon, we've talked a bit about the genomic medicine service in the NHS, which is scaling very fast for all sorts of different types of genetic and genomic tests, including whole genome sequencing. There will therefore be more and more individuals, families going through the processes that we've just talked about. How can we scale the types of meaningful human conversations, the process of people informing themselves and making informed choices about what's going on? Do we just need to hire tons and tons more genetic counselors? Are there other ways that we can scale this? How can we almost kind of industrialize this without losing those vital human interactions, which are so important in as people go through these incredibly, often incredibly difficult situations?
And I think this is where what's happening at the moment is really interesting, particularly around, as I said, I originally trained as a nurse. Nurses are the largest patient-facing workforce, both nationally and internationally. And in England, there is a lot of work going on at the moment in upskilling nurses, not to provide specialist genetic healthcare, but to be aware of what's coming. And I think it's about the teachable moment. It's about giving health professionals who already have skills in dealing with complex information and managing patients the confidence and the tools to start introducing these conversations and then using their conversation skills to continue the conversations. There's a great quote I use in some talks from a nurse participant in a course in the Southwest, and they use the quote in a talk, which is about nurses are the translators of complex information, and so we need to know the language in relation to genomics. So there's something about that. There's something about not being wedded to past models of care. You know, for example, when I started doing being a genetic nurse, my main job was driving around the south of England doing home visits. And I would talk with families, but it was really preparing them for the clinic and getting information for the doctor. We don't do that now. That's a resource issue. But it probably wasn't necessary. But what was helpful then is we had a lot more time to do follow-up care once the diagnosis was made. And for me, that's a really important part of healthcare we need to get into the system for, certainly for the people with the high-risk, high-penetrant single gene disorders. But again, that's about upskilling the people out there. The original National Genetics Education Centre had this concept of, in this care pathway, you don't describe, you know, the doctor does this, the nurse does this, the genetic counsellor does this. You say, these are the things that need to happen to the patient in their journey. Who are the best people to provide that aspect of care and how can we enable them to do it? And so that's how I like to think of it. There never will be enough resources for what everything we'd want to do. There also may be technological solutions. Genetic counsellors, you know, in the recent past have spent a lot of time, in a sense, doing teaching. There's this model of teaching, you know, genetic counselling as teaching or genetic counselling as psychotherapy. I think we lie somewhere very much in the interface between those two things. But the didactic information giving, teaching things can be done in by all sorts of interesting, innovative ways. Providing tools to allow people to explore, for example, communication with their family members can now also be done in all sorts of interesting ways. And as genetic counselling professionals, we are starting to think through some of those, and there's some really interesting stuff happening. But to me, it doesn't take away the value of that one-to-one conversation when it's necessary. You know, if we think of chatbots, the genetic counselling chatbots that are working have only worked because essentially genetic counsellors have been intensively involved in developing them with their clients, if we call them, with the people that are going to be using them.
It's interesting you took the word chatbots out of my mouth, actually. I was just wondering whether to go there or not. And I found it really fascinating over the last few years, some of the lived experience of people interacting with chatbots, with text message services, whether that's in suicide prevention and kind of crisis interactions. And it's been really interesting to see how people who are used in their everyday life to using messaging platforms like WhatsApp or text messaging or whatever, clearly there is a community, not necessarily a community, there are clearly lots of people out there who would actually prefer to have this very difficult or sensitive conversation via messaging platforms rather than face-to-face. But equally clearly, there will be lots of people for whom that's completely abhorrent and just dehumanizes the whole situation. And so I guess we come back once again to kind of choice and having to allow for different preferences, different choices, and so on.
Yeah, and trying to, if I think of the genetic counselling research space, trying to distill out what are the critical elements. Again, practice develops. And we do things because we've done them in the past and we think it works. What's interesting, of course, about in the current time is the pandemic has driven a cart and horses through some of our historical practices. So for me, it's about questioning, distilling out what is the important thing about this interaction that is making it work. And can we distill out on a more general level factors that make interactions work, factors that don't? Those sorts of things, and then build them into our interactions with people or designing systems to allow people to interact with machines. I am in my 60s, but early 60s, I have to say. Digital exclusion is a real issue. my kids are in their late 30s, so even the world that they're the next generation down there is alien to them, it's almost completely alien to me. And I've been forced to engage with it through carrying on with this work.
I guess, which comes back to heterogeneity, right? And having different horses or for courses or pathways for people with different preferences. But ensuring, I think your point is, as we embrace these new technologies where it's relevant, we have to make sure we're not leaving people behind.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're not excluding even more people, because again, back to the NHS, the fundamental principle is equity.
Yeah. And there's maybe an interesting analogy there for things like banking, right, where we've seen so much of the shift to apps and call centers and so on, but we still have branches. And actually, if you are not someone who wants to interact with your bank through an app, you can still go into your branch. And I guess it's about how do we get that mixed model right in healthcare. Maybe final question. If we fast forward to, I don't know, 2030, 2040, if we've got this right, all of these very complicated things that we need to do, what does the world look like? If we, maybe if we, you know, we've come a long way since the late 80s, we're now in 2021, I guess the same time period again takes us to about 2050. What could that look like? Paint a picture for us. What would the utopian version of this look like? And what do we need to do in order to move to utopia and not dystopia?
Right. Okay. Horizon scanning is always, because we don't know. I mean, the answer is we don't know. In a way, genomics will be old hat by then. You know, it's just, for me, it's the exemplar case of the sort of desire to integrate lots and lots of data to get answers of questions. And genomics is the first case. There will be others. So that's the first.
To some extent, that's a sign of success, right? It's like we take X-rays for granted, right? We take, that were at some point miraculous.
Yeah. I hope we won't have solved all the problems. We won't have solved all the medical problems. There still will be some genetic disorders that we don't understand. I hope the utopian village is that we do have trust and transparency about the use of big data, but also that the questions that are asked of the big data are useful, interesting, and relevant to the people who have allowed access to that data. And that it's a democratization. It's not just, you know, a huge academic research group saying we want to do this study because this is our lifelong mission to solve this problem. So therefore you have to give me that data and I from this position of expertise will do the work, and then gradually I'll bestow it upon you through my largesse. Or if I ever get it published through the publishers, publications, it's more about that democratization so that we all share in this.
Fantastic. Well, I very much hope that we collectively stick on the right course to head towards that vision. Dr. Christine Patch, thank you so much for your time this morning and for everything that you're doing in this field.
Thank you.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series. I'd appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.